Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. In his new book, music journalist John Millward traces the evolution of blues music across American history, connecting the often long-lost songs of sharecroppers to the rock and roll of bands like the Rolling Stones, celebrated by white teenagers. Millward, from Woodstock, has been the pop music critic for the Chicago Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and USA Today, and his writings also appeared in the New York Times and Rolling Stone, to name a few. But in Crossroads, How the Blues Shaped Rock and Roll and Rock Saved the Blues, which is published by Northeast University Press, the idea of blues becoming pop music is often beside the point. Many of the musicians and producers Millward features, especially in the early years, were has-beens and never-will-bes recording their music for posterity. But in music, timing is everything. So when some of the record fetishists who helped give bluesmen eternity found out they had fellow fanatics across the ocean in the form of Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, and Eric Clapton, the blues was given a second life it enjoys to this day. John Millward, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is a book largely about the music of the South, but it also has a Hudson Valley connection. It was almost a who's who of people we hear about on WAMC all the time. Tell us about approaching this book from your vantage point in Woodstock.
Well, there is a little element from the Woodstock. It's really about the blues, the Delta blues in Chicago and to England, and also the scene around Greenwich Village. And there's an umbilical cord between Greenwich Village and Woodstock. So in that sense, one of the first Woodstock personality that people know about is Albert Grossman, who was Bob Dylan's manager. And Bob Dylan's first gig at the Gaslight Cafe in Greenwich Village was opening for John Lee Hooker. And he was soon managed by Grossman, who got his songs on Peter, Paul, and Mary records. The first one of those actually also included a Reverend Gary Davis song. So the blues kind of got mixed up in Greenwich Village, and some of it moved to Woodstock.
There was always a search for the real and for the authentic when it came to rediscovering blues artists. I wondered if you could take us a little further into the way the folk scene that was happening in the park and in Greenwich Village kind of latched on to some of this blues music.
Well, another Woodstock personality, Happy Traum.
Mm-hmm. And friend of WAMC, we should say.
Okay. I studied with Brownie McGee. He was at NYU and was looking for a guitar teacher and looked up Brownie McGee, who was famous for being a duo with Sonny Terry on harmonica. And Happy would go to Harlem each week dutifully and take his lessons. And so, and as I mentioned, Gary Davis was kind of the same thing. He was kind of the book grew out of a story I wrote about Gary Davis, the sons of Gary Davis. And that's where all these guitar players like David Bromberg and Ry Cooter would take lessons with Gary Davis, who wasn't rediscovered as much as found living in New York. He was playing on street corners and playing in storefront churches, and he would give you a lesson for $5.
So we all know about the Lomax tapes, but how were these musicians found?
Well, Lomax could have been a clue, although he wasn't, as it turned out. One in particular, probably the most famous story, is about rediscovering Mississippi John Hurt. And these blues collectors, he recorded in 1928 and 29, didn't have a whole lot of tracks released. More were in the can, and they were circulated in tapes. And there was some collectors in Dick Spotswood got a tape in Washington, D.C., and he and Tom Spotswood were listening to it, and there was a song called Avalon Blues. Avalon is my home, said John Hurt. And so kind of on a whim, Hoskins stopped in Avalon, Mississippi on the way back from New Orleans from going to Mardi Gras.
In a stolen car, right?
Well,
semi.
Well, it wasn't quite a stolen car. He had struck up a flirtation with a woman at a party in D.C., and said, boy, I really want to go to New Orleans, but I don't have wheels. Oh, I've got a new Dodge. Turned out to be her father's Dodge. She was underage. There was like the equivalent of an Amber Alert out for him. Meanwhile, he's driving into Avalon, stops at the post office general store and said, is Mississippi John Hurt still alive? Uh-huh. And the guy behind the counter responded, Well, if he hasn't passed since he was in here at 11 this morning getting some groceries, he's just down the road a piece.
I said, you and the Kenny man, you're getting mighty sick. Mm-hmm. You must be stuck on the Kenny man stick. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
When those kind of discoveries happened, it was one of two paths. The option that a blues musician would be recorded kind of in situ and then on tape forever and would go on living in relative obscurity. Or two, they'd sort of be rediscovered and brought to folk festivals and given tour dates and things like that. What kind of determined if a blues musician who had, you know, had a pre-war career and been living in obscurity for maybe 20 years got that second life? And how come it seemed to happen to some people and not others?
Well, some never really left the life. Booker White was a guy who recorded in the 40s mostly and was living in Memphis, happened to be B.B. King's cousin. And he was just rediscovered when John Fahey wrote just a letter to Booker White in Memphis, Tennessee. It found its way there somehow. And so he had never really stopped, although it wasn't providing his living. He was working in a factory. Somebody like Mississippi John Hurt was tending for cattle and at a little farmstead.
And you're right, really like living on the edge of making a living.
No, absolutely. These were people who had lived sharecropper existences, essentially. And music was something they'd play, you know, for a local fish fry or whatever. But John Hurt certainly didn't expect to have a second career. And yet, part of it is also personality, because John Hurt was kind of this grandfatherly presence. Mm-hmm. And he played very melodic fingerstyle music and songs that were blues, but were also drawn from the folk canon, from religious canon. So he was very approachable and kind of for people. Whereas somebody like Son House, who was rediscovered a year later in 1964, he was a cranky old drunk. And but a very powerful musician. And he had a little tougher time communicating to the quote-unquote peace and love crowd.
The backdrop to the book is race. So you've got the kind of upper middle class, you know, college kids who have developed an interest in the blues. And they're acting as anthropologically almost to capture this music. And then you have the rock and roll happening where the blues is being ingested and then turned into a more palatable pop music or rock and roll idiom. How much did race complicate the relationship between blues and rock and roll for the people kind of on the ground?
Well, it was a little different in the United States and in Britain, mm-hmm. which is the other focus here. And in the U.S., like when Tom Hoskins was traveling through Mississippi looking for Mississippi John Hurt, there were also college students down there registering voters. It was a very explosive time to be in a car with an underage girl with an out-of-state license plate driving through Mississippi. And the same thing the next year when Dick Waterman was among a crew who found Son House. And they were really kind of from the folk world. And so that was where they performed, where they were an outgrowth of record collectors, too. These were obsessive music people who weren't really concerned with what was on the charts. They'd be looking for an old 78 from 1932 and ignore the fact that Muddy Waters had a hit on the R&B charts. It was just a different world. Whereas in Chicago, people growing up like Paul Butterfield and Mike Bloomfield, this is the music they heard on the radio, the late night radio. And they said, wow, we can see these guys at a club. So that was, you know, Bloomfield and Butterfield would both be getting underage into these clubs and just absorbing the music and soon would be up performing with these guys. But for Americans like that, there was definitely a racial thing. Are you stealing our music? The black musicians were very aware of that. Over in England, it was just an alien thing. They, too, were the record collectors. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards met each other because Jagger was holding a Muddy Waters album. They got their name from a Muddy Waters song, Rolling Stone. So for them, it was alien, but it wasn't in their face, as it were. And it kind of gave them the stylistic musical liberty to change the music they were doing.
The subtitle of your book is How Rock Saved the Blues. So how did it?
People like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and even B.B. King, in the early 60s, they were struggling because the young black audience didn't really want to identify with the blues. This is the past, particularly in the era of civil rights and whatnot. They were more turned on by the Motown sound and by James Brown and Ray Charles. And so the bluesmen were still making a living, but having to struggle harder, not selling many records. So when they suddenly got this unexpected exposure through people like the Rolling Stones and the Butterfield Blues Band, it opened up a new world, not just of white people, but of the style kind of moving around the world a bit.
Okay, let's tackle the idea of authorship. Much has been made about Led Zeppelin updating blues songs. All of a sudden, you've got rock and roll happening without proper credits going to the writers oftentimes. You write that this was happening 100 years ago in blues. You change a lyric, all of a sudden the original credit is gone forever. So why is that so endemic to the blues?
Partly because it's an oral tradition from back, you know, in the 20th century. And there'd be kind of a common pool of lyrics and guitar licks and whatnot. And as any creative artist does, they kind of look at what they like and are influenced by and then try to take it somewhere else. Variation. Walking blues was cut by Sun House, was cut by Robert Johnson, any number of people. And they would just throw their own, another lyric in there. And in their case, it wasn't that valuable.
Right.
You couldn't monetize. That's kind of the way folk music works.
They'd often be paid $50 for the session and take that deal over a royalty.
Right. They had the choice, but most, a lot of particularly early blues musicians figured, we're never going to see any money off that, so I'll take the money now and hope it pays off later. But when these were updated in the 60s by rock musicians who could have the ability to sell a lot of records, suddenly there was money involved. The funny thing about the Led Zeppelin thing, it was based on a obscure Muddy Waters song from 1962, You Need Love. But Led Zeppelin heard it when it was performed by the Small Faces, another, you know, British pop band. But by the time Whole Lotta Love was a huge hit, and it took Willie Dixon, who wrote the song, 20 years for his children to say, Dad, you know, you should check this out. There might be something interesting here. But needless to say, he settled with Led Zeppelin, but the Small Faces never heard from him.
Hmm. Let's go back to the title of your book for a second, Crossroads, which is maybe the defining feeling to the way blues and rock have interacted with each other. It's a famous old blues lyric. It's Eric Clapton's Guitar Festival. What is bound up in that term, crossroads?
Well, it's kind of the old, kind of hairy blues legend of Robert Johnson, who purportedly went out at midnight at a Mississippi Delta crossroads and signed away his soul to the devil, who for his extraordinary musical ability. And that's kind of a lot of hooey, but it's kind of part and parcel with the allure of the old blues. And in the book, I kind of make a contention that Robert Johnson was really was at a crossroads, as it were, of the blues, because he, instead of just pulling the common music and lyrical threads, was creating a really vibrant and unique sort of catalog of songs, which kind of pointed to the more self-conscious writings of somebody like Bob Dylan, who said when he heard those first songs, he like wrote down the lyrics so he could see how they scanned and was really studying it. So in that sense, Robert Johnson making a deal with the devil, ultimately getting poisoned by the husband of a woman he was purportedly having an affair with. He was later, decades later, became a huge record star, selling millions of records, and then was even involved in a paternity suit. So all in all, I would say that made him a good rock star. But finally, the crossroads to rock was, as you mentioned, with Eric Clapton, when Cream cut that in 1968 at the Fillmore West. That turned, you know, millions of kids onto Robert Johnson.
I had a buddy guy on, honored to talk to him on the show several months ago, and asked him, he's one of those links to an earlier era of the blues, about how he felt about white rock stars appropriating the blues, you know, to find this new ground for themselves. And he loves it. It's brought him a lot more attention, certainly, and they've paid their dues to Buddy Guy, and he's featured on stage with everyone in the second half of your book, really, from maybe Clapton on. Were there people who resented the rock and roll appropriation of blues music? Because certainly it did a lot for the genre, but we talked today about the Rolling Stones as gods, and half of the people in the first half of your book I've never heard of before.
Well, again, a lot of the people from the Delta, the first half of the book, were the purview of record collectors. Like, there's a guy who, the first line of the book is a 16-year-old record collector finding Skip James album 78 in 1952 that was recorded 20 years earlier. Like, Skip James could have totally disappeared. But because of that interest, he was among the ones rediscovered and who played in the folk festivals. But some musicians are built to last and for popularity, and some don't. It's like, this is B.B. King's 88th birthday. And for me, he's kind of the one of the through lines in this book. And all the time I was working on it, I couldn't help but think, boy, is B going to be around when this comes out? And sure enough, he's out there gigging.
Yeah.
And so B.B. King is a guy who worked like crazy all through the 50s on the Chitlin circuit, and then found a new life when he was suddenly playing the Fillmore, and suddenly the Love children were listening to him. And he was influencing a lot of rock people along the way, from Carlos Santana to Mike Bloomfield, and obviously Eric Clapton, who later cut an album with him. But others might have been bitter because they didn't have the talent that could communicate across what was a dramatic new boundary line. It in the beginning, the blues was just for the black community, and specifically the rural black community. And then it kind of changed in the 50s with Chess and Muddy and Howlin' Wolf, but it was still largely a black thing. And so a lot of black people couldn't communicate with white people and vice versa. And obviously the issue of money caused resentment.
You play a little six string yourself. How did your research, exhaustive research into the blues, influence your own style?
Well, I think the book kind of developed out of, I was a rock critic for 20, 25 years, actively pursuing every rock star who came through town. And as I grew older, you just start to appreciate the rootsier elements of the music. And that's what kind of turned me into more of a blues freak. And in midlife, I started playing guitar again. I dropped it during college. And it really, it's funny, the little exercise for me was learning to play songs by these different artists. Some, you know, I could do my little Mississippi John Hurt or a Skip James, but Howlin' Wolf, forget about it.
Too hard?
Well, it's just, it doesn't work. You need that huge howling voice and a very deft, simple guitar, but it's kind of in the presentation more than the finger picking.
As you look back on the history you've traced, is there a particular artist who, you know, maybe this project led you to listen to something you hadn't heard before that you admire more?
The one seminal album which I discovered I was totally unaware of, Buddy Guy was on that, the 1965 Hoodoo Blues with Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, which is regarded as the first accurate reflection of what a Chicago blues band sounded like. Because before that, they would have different musicians and try to aim a recording session for a hit, whereas they recorded Buddy and Junior doing their club set for like 10 hours and took the best tracks. So in a sense, that was a terribly influential record for people like Clapton. When he formed Cream, he said, I want to be like Buddy and Junior. But that was the one discovery. I pretty much knew, I was well-versed in it already. And I guess if I had to, I'm still on that B.B. King tip, I'd have to say that, you know, in high school, that was the first artist who got me into this. And it was through the influence of reading about Clapton and Mike Bloomfield. And so my friend and I went out and we bought B.B. King's Live at the Regal. And it just felt like something from another planet for some kids in the white kids in the suburbs to be listening to this really lively Southside Chicago crowd and B.B. King just perfectly rapport with his audience.
What do you think the future of the blues is? You know, I saw Derek Trucks a couple weeks ago with the Allman Brothers, really tremendous guitar player who's young, so you figure we have a lot of decades of his blues to look forward to. I think about a guy like John Mayer, who's a kind of a pop idol, but a seriously mean blues guitar player when he wants to be. Where do you see this going?
Well, I think it's kind of gone, in a sense. I think it's part of our vocabulary now. And Jeff Muldaur, who is in the Queskin Jug Band and also lived in Woodstock for
and
a bit.
They just reunited here in Albany.
It's 50 years. Yeah. Everything's 50 years ago.
Yeah.
He mentioned that sad thing I was just speculating on, that when B.B. King dies, that'll be the last of the real innovators. Because even somebody like Buddy Guy, who's pushing 76 or something, he was clearly influenced by B and was of the next generation. And Muldaur contended that at that point it becomes kind of a classical music form. And so and that doesn't mean that it'll only be performed in imitation, but music's come and go. And the blues happens to be part of the fabric of many kind of, it's in jazz, it's in rock, obviously. And it's just a fundamental element of the music. But in a sense, you know, I grew up loving rock and roll. And you can, in 2013, you could look around and say, wow, we're a rock band now. You know, and so they're out there and there is an audience, but it's more rarefied. And so you had to seek it out more.
Well, that's John Millward. He's the author of Crossroads, How the Blues Shaped Rock and Roll and Rock Saved the Blues, a new book published by Northeast University Press. John, it's such a pleasure to have read the book and to have had the chance to talk with you about it. And thanks for coming up and seeing us.
Thank you, Ian.
It's my own fault, babe. Treat me the way you want to do. It's my own fault, baby. Treat me the way you want to do. That's when you were loving me, baby. Oh, at that time, little girl, I didn't love you.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.